I think we're going to get started. I'm Judy Samuelson. I am the director of the Business and Society Program at the Aspen Institute. Can everybody hear in the back? I just realized we're not actually mic'd into the room. They're just mic'd for recording purposes. So if at any point in time you can't hear in the back row, either move up. There's lots of chairs up front. And we'll make this that way as much of a conversation as we possibly can. Or raise your hand, because we want to make sure everybody can hear and engage to the maximum extent possible. We have a wonderful panel today assembled to talk about this question of business and business's impulse and the ability to for business to be an agent in creating public good. And we have a couple of wonderful examples in the room of enterprises that have started up on these principles. I would call them social enterprises or social ventures. That can cover a wide range of different kinds of activities. I think that what all of the business ventures or social ventures and social entrepreneurship have in common is that they all use market-like activity, business skills, market making to the ends of public good or social good. And the two examples, as we talked this morning and got to know one another a bit preparing for the panel today, they actually have a lot in common. And I hope one of the things that continues to happen in our panel today, as it was over breakfast this morning, is how much our two examples were actually interested in each other's models and learning from each other. And I think they're networking to a fairly well already, so it's already a great success. Just to start out this morning, I would say that the private sector as a change agent is, of course, in some respects, kind of a controversial idea. I mean, we've gone through a decade of the private sector plummeting in terms of the public trust, and lots of questions about the motivations of business, greed, misdeed. And a lot of attention has been brought to the malfeasance of business over the last several years. What we have as a counterpoint to that is a real strong surge of interest. We work a lot with business schools, and we see it evidenced there. A real surge of interest in business and its tremendous capacity to tackle complex social and environmental problems. And there are lots of examples of that are starting to seize the imagination in businesses large and small. And again, this morning we have two particular examples that we're going to talk about. One is Ethos Water, represented by Jonathan Greenblatt. And the other one is Arzu. Do you say Arzu Rug? Is that what you call it for short? Or
Arzu
for short. And both Susan Thistlewaite from the Chicago Theological Seminary and has been involved in this for several years. And Connie Duckworth is actually the founder of this enterprise. So we're going to get to both of those examples in a few minutes. But I wanted to first, it's a great pleasure to introduce Madeline Albright, who, of course, doesn't need an introduction. What I would say about her is that she is a very active trustee of the Aspen Institute and has been very involved, including starting a strategy group on the Middle East that embeds some of these principles from its very origin. So we hope to hear a little bit about that later. But Madeline, will you help set the stage this morning?
Well, thank you very much, and I'm very glad to be a part of this panel. I think some of you may have heard me already say this, but I think as one looks out at the various problems in the world, and we've been talking about terrorism and missiles and various very threatening things, I truly do believe that the greatest problem is the divide between the rich and the poor. And that is one, I think, that is out there and that underlies a lot of the other issues that we have. In a variety of polling that has come out, and I've been involved with this group called the Pew Charitable Trust that has done a lot of huge global polling. In a survey that we did a couple of years ago, it was very evident that the divide between the rich and the poor was a major issue. People actually like Americans. They don't like our policies, but they like Americans. They like the people. They like our technology. But in terms of this rich-poor divide, they actually think we're selfish. For which there is good reason in terms of public policy, because what is the truth is that there are many people, if I were to ask what is the size of our budget that goes to foreign assistance, people might say 20 or 25%, because that's people talk about it as a giveaway program and putting money into a black hole. It's actually less than 1%, which puts us in a very bad position versus the other industrialized countries of the world. So the rich-poor divide is a very big issue. There has also been a big discussion in assistance communities or various groups that want to figure out how to help the developing world, the poor world, is whether assistance is better or trade is better. And there are lots of arguments about the pros and cons. We'll probably get into that. But I begin to feel more and more it's obviously a combination, but that it's very important to encourage local businesses so that they can participate in the global economy. And when I was secretary, we also began to, first of all, we passed the Africa Growth and Opportunity Act, but I began to see, much to my own surprise, the value of cooperation between business and government. And the question is how American businesses, both large and small, behave when they're in foreign countries. So we began to give a prize to both large and small corporations that actually were good citizens in the countries where they were, undertook social responsibility issues. So that was a direction that we were already going in. Now, I have to admit, in my post-secretarial life, I now have a business which does global consulting, and we, in fact, have some clients, the kind that Judy described a little bit, those that don't have had some problems domestically, who actually are pretty good citizens internationally doing this kind of public-private partnership, and one is Merck. If anybody had ever told me that I would have anything to do with a pharmaceutical, I would have told them they were crazy. What they have done, however, Merck and the Gates Foundation, each having put in $50 million, has worked on a national HIV and AIDS plan for Botswana, and they are working with the government in Botswana to do things like that. Coca-Cola, for instance, is another company that uses its vast distribution network to see whether they can help in providing information and also talking to vaccine people on HIV and AIDS. Some of it because it's out of generosity. Some of it is because they find that their workers are dying of HIV and AIDS. So I think that, but just to stress the issue of the public-private partnership and understanding the importance of that. Now, the thing that I am most involved in now on this is something totally different, which I don't know how many of you know of this Peruvian economist called Hernando de Soto. He has a theory that there actually is money within poor countries if poor people were given access to being a part of their economy. And he is suggesting that that be done by the fact that people actually get title to the land that they own. They own it through years, but they don't have a piece of paper. And the piece of paper would entitle them to go and borrow against the land, get mortgages, be a part, be able to participate in microenterprise. Now, because nothing in life is without controversy, there are questions about that, whether it's too much of a conservative concept, which is probably why I'm on the panel. But I think that it's a very interesting one. And just to give you a couple of figures, the informal economy is growing dramatically in low-income countries, with the biggest increases in informality concentrating the poorest places. In low-income countries, 47% of the GDP is generated through the informal economy, and in high-income countries, it's only 13% through the informal economy. So you can see what happens. More than 70% of workers in the developing world are now in the informal economy. That's to say that 2 out of 3 people work under the table. So I think that that's a real issue about how you get businesses involved in developing countries. I think that this is a very interesting commission. It's an international commission. We are all working on it, and I hope over the years that I can keep everybody informed on it, because it is one way of looking at how to help within developing countries. It's not, again, also without its issues, but I think very much worth looking at. I think I'm looking forward very much to hearing the panelists in terms of the kinds of things they're doing, always keeping in mind that the major problem is the divide between the rich and the poor.
Excellent. Thank you. thought we, before we get started, I just wanted to scan the room a little bit. Some of you were came in after we talked a little bit about the definition of social enterprise. So let me just repeat that I think that it can span a wide range of different kinds of activities, using markets to attract business talent and capacity to some very complex systemic problems. And we have two great examples of ways in which that's happening here this morning. I'm just curious, by show of hands, are any of you involved in something that you would consider a social enterprise? All right. There's a lot of you. So I would quickly, I would include both nonprofits that are incorporating business-like activity and utilizing markets for social good, for-profits, we have examples of both on our panel this morning, that have a kind of a double bottom line approach. So I'm going to very quickly, let's just take a sample of some of the things that are out there. Don't describe them too much. Just quickly give us some ideas.
Well, I'm involved in education on the board of a local college.
Okay. Others? Social enterprise, business-like activity. Yes, quickly.
I'm on the executive board of our local AIDS hospice, and I'm the president of PR in Santa Barbara.
Okay. I'm hearing nonprofits. I'm curious about the business activity and market, using markets. Any other examples? Yes.
Low-income housing in Europe and Pakistan.
Okay, that's getting close. Yes. In the back, please.
We run a hospital in India, Hyderabad.
I'm sorry, say it again.
We run a hospital in India, Hyderabad.
A hospital in Ahmedabad. All right, excellent. Yes?
I'm in the Inter-American Development Bank. We have a social entrepreneurship program that we finance micro-enterprises and startups with the social conscience, including low-income housing, including micro-insurance, micro-lending, and micro-leasing.
A whole range of activities. Okay, others? Yes.
In El Salvador, trying to get consistent water supply to farmers.
Excellent. Good connections to make here. Yes.
Greater Houston Community Foundation. We stimulate collaboration with business and social activity.
All right. Any others? Quickly. Yes, sir.
International hotel business.
Uh-huh. International hotel business. Okay. And the upside, the social part of it?
Yes. But it is two businesses, the international customer and a local customer. So you get both,
and hiring people, I'm sure.
All right, so we have a wide range evident right in the room. Let's turn to our first example, Jonathan. Jonathan, one of the things I learned about Jonathan Greenblatt this morning is he literally started this business in his son's bedroom. So what we're going to start this morning is talk a little bit about how you got into this, if you would first, and then tell us about the model of Ethos Water. And then we'll turn to our second example and then open it up from there.
Sounds great.
Okay.
So my name is Jonathan Greenblatt. I was one of the two founders of Ethos Water, and I'm going to talk to you a bit about that today. Sure. Yeah, these mics are
no,
they're, yeah, they're not. They're. thanks for letting us know. Keep letting us know if you can't hear.
So Ethos Water is a business that started in 2001. My business partner, a fellow named Peter Thum, who I'd gone to business school with, was on a consulting assignment in South Africa. I don't know if any of you have had the opportunity to visit South Africa, particularly the townships. They're some of the most impoverished pockets of humanity in the world. And he was there for the first time in a developing country and saw firsthand how people were living in these shanty towns in refrigerator boxes without electricity, certainly without paved roads, and without running water. It deeply affected Pete. He came back to the U.S. and gave me a call and said, you know, he had a background in the beverage industry. And he thought, well, let's see. There are all these people who lack clean drinking water. And when you start to do the research, you will learn that the world water crisis is arguably the largest public health issue of our time. I don't know how many of you know some of the statistics, but over 1 billion people lack clean drinking water. 2.5 billion, 40% of the world's population, lacks basic sanitation, like a latrine where they can go to the bathroom or a place to wash their hands. So it's an enormous problem, and it has a massive mortality impact. Water-related diseases are the leading cause of death among children around the world. They say a child dies every 14 seconds from a water-related disease. And other issues like HIV/AIDS are very much exacerbated by water. You certainly can't treat people in sub-Saharan Africa who are suffering from AIDS if you don't have clean water. And migration patterns are greatly affected as tribes and people will move to places where there are water sources, bringing with them communicable diseases. So it's a huge problem that has very low awareness here in the United States. But what's interesting in the United States, while people don't know about the world water crisis, bottled water is a very big business, right? It's an $8 billion business here in the United States alone. 150 million Americans drink it every day. So the opportunity that we saw was, how could we link the 150 million consumers here in the U.S. with the billions of people in need around the world? So we decided to create a product called Ethos Water. And I will tell you right now, I'm sorry, I went to the local Starbucks to get a couple bottles this morning. They didn't have any. Otherwise, I would have right here.
How many of you have seen the product? All right, probably. So the demo was already made.
Cool.
Good.
So Ethos Water was founded in my son's bedroom in 2002 with a very simple idea. Help children get clean water and raise awareness about the world water crisis. We were helping children get clean water because we aspire to donate 50% of our profits to bring clean water to children and communities in need around the world. And we endeavored to raise awareness by using all of our marketing, all of our promotions, all of our communication as an opportunity to educate people here in the United States about the world water crisis, to do it in an aspirational and really hopeful manner. So not to exploit the poverty in which these people live, but rather to allow consumers here to understand their opportunity to do something powerful, to do something meaningful, even in the simple act of simply drinking a bottle of water. So the business grew quite nicely. We scaled throughout the western United States in places like Whole Foods, Cost Plus. And then in 2005, we were approached by Starbucks. Now, we had come to Starbucks because we believed it could be a terrific outlet through which we could distribute our water. Starbucks came to us and said, we actually don't just want to sell your water in our stores. We want to buy your brand because they saw great alignment. Starbucks is clearly a company that's growing quite rapidly, right? Five Starbucks open every single day here in the United States. It's amazing. At the same time, it's a company that lacked any one coherent single issue, if you will. As Howard Schultz and the management team looked ahead, they saw that water would be a great issue in the countries where they hoped to grow, right? China, India, Brazil. And additionally, the countries from which they source their coffee and tea are all water-stricken countries. So we made the decision to sell the brand and the company to Starbucks in 2005, but on some very specific conditions. Most importantly, they maintained and scaled our mission. So when we sold the business, we changed the model, no longer donating 50% of profits, but donating at least a nickel for every unit that we would sell. Wherever we would sell the water, no matter what size, at least 5 cents would always go to bringing clean water to children. And we set up the Ethos Water Fund within the Starbucks Foundation to do that. And I think today, this year, we'll do probably about 1.5 million, and the brand will grow dramatically.
We'll 1.5 million in sales or 1.5 million in distribution?
In distribution, donations.
Donations.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. At the same time, we also got Starbucks to agree to continue with this mission of education and awareness building. Because to be honest, the average cost to provide someone with a lifetime supply of clean water, any guesses about how much that might cost? To give someone in Afghanistan or someone in Pakistan or India?
$1,000?
$500? $25. Is the average cost to provide someone with a lifetime supply of clean water. So the stats are amazing. This is a problem that can be solved. But to be really honest, if we contributed $10, $20 million, $50 million, it's still just a drop in the bucket. So what no pun intended. So what we really saw as the opportunity was to use Starbucks, the 5,000 stores here in the United States that are company owned, as classrooms. And there are 40 million people walking through those stores every week. And that was really the opportunity that got us very excited. How can we get our message out to 40 million people a week? Because it's not the money that really matters at the end of the day. It's building awareness. It's growing the consciousness. Because if we could get imagine if just 1% of those 40 million people bought our water and actually read the label, and maybe 1% of that, which would be somewhere in the order of 400 people a week, were so inspired by the idea that they can do something, that they can make a difference. Maybe they would volunteer some time. Maybe they would make a donation. Maybe they would start their own social venture. That was really what got us very excited. And I'm proud to say the brand has grown enormously. This year, as I was mentioning, we'll donate $1.5 million. We'll also do about $50 million in sales. So the brand is now distributed in 5,000 company-owned Starbucks across the U.S., and we just completed a deal with PepsiCo. So Pepsi will be distributing the water as well within the next 12 months, which means
they'll be distributing it through
the Pepsi system, if you will. So wherever you see a can of Pepsi
to retailers
or a bottle of Aquafina mm-hmm. in a convenience store, a grocery store, a restaurant, you'll soon be seeing Ethos, 12, 18 months. So I think we have the opportunity to build what may be the first brand in this bottled water category that actually has some emotional appeal to consumers. This isn't just a commodity, but rather that inspires something in all of us.
Jonathan, before we move on, talk a little bit about the back end. Talk about the, you know, what's happening with the proceeds, with the nickel,
it's a good question.
A nickel a bottle, or mm-hmm. any of the stories that have come out mm-hmm. of the connections that have been made.
It's really extraordinary. When we started Ethos, we worked with McKinsey and Company and developed a strategy on the nonprofit side. So we did a very detailed analysis of the landscape of water as an issue, from who, what regions are most impacted. How can you solve the problem? What are the NGOs or non-governmental organizations that are doing the best work? What kind of projects are most efficacious? And using that strategy that we developed, it became almost like a methodology to identify really effective groups on the ground in these countries to whom we could direct funds to make a difference. So we're continuing to do that today. And I just, late last year in December, I was in Ethiopia and Kenya. And I've got to tell you, visiting these rural isolated communities, you know, and you're not talking, I mean, the situation is so dire. Women walk in sub-Saharan Africa in the rural environments on average 6 miles a day to get water. They spend hours and hours, and we're not talking about leisurely strolls between here and, you know, Pepke Hall, right? They're getting up at the crack of dawn before the sun comes up in bare feet, often with a child, walking through difficult terrain, and then when they get the water, which isn't clean, they're carrying it back with a gourd or a bucket or a can that used to be used for gasoline, and it weighs 20 or 30 or 40 pounds, and then they're doing that hike back. So I have visited these rural communities. I have met these women and their families, and their lives are forever changed. Suddenly they have a well in their community and a latrine, and they have a bath, so they no longer have to go to these fetid water sources to bathe their children. They no longer have to go to these fetid water sources to get water for their.
And how did that actually, tell just very quickly how that part came about.
How?
Like, how did the well get built? How did the water source?
We often find that we work with brokers here in the United States, non-governmental or charitable groups, that have relationships with these indigenous organizations in, let's say, rural Ethiopia. The money goes in. It's used to dig wells, build latrines, which are often really, the technology is not complicated. PVC piping is about as technical as it gets. Rope pumps that use bicycle tires to bring the water up from under the ground. And a big part of what we actually do is hygiene education, because education is fundamental. Because in these cultures, there often isn't a tradition of, again, washing your hands after you defecate, or making sure that you keep the livestock separate from the children, so you're using they're using different water sources. And so we'll work with groups like CARE, UNICEF, WaterAid, and lots of other small organizations that you probably haven't heard of before to bring clean water to these communities.
Great. All right. Let's move on to our zoo. Connie has a background, an extensive background in business, primarily at Goldman Sachs, and has used that network, among other things, to create an extraordinary entrepreneurial venture that involves Afghan and rugs. And I'm going to turn it over to you, Connie, to tell us more about that story.
Thank you.
And again, how you got into it to begin with would be part of the story we'd love to hear.
Thank you. As Judy said, I really spent my youth at Goldman Sachs. I was one of the very early and first women partners of the firm. I was very fortunate to be part of the IPO. And so after 20 years there, I really felt that in terms of looking at my portfolio of time, it was time for me to adjust. We often think of portfolios in terms of investments, and you reach a point in your life where you realize that your most important opportunity for investment is your time and your skill set. So I retired from the firm, and coincidental to that, I've always been passionate about women's rights, particularly women's economic empowerment.
because it's so well known that you give a woman an opportunity to earn 2 cents, and the first thing she will do is educate her children. The second thing she will do is lift a neighbor out of poverty. And so that having been a passion and an interest of mine, a friend called and threw my name in the hat for a bipartisan State Department commission that was being formed right after the fall of the Taliban to help support Afghan women through a public-private partnership. And this is called the U.S.-Afghan Women's Council. So I get this call saying, I know you really have this thing about Afghan women, and you have all this time on your hands now, so maybe you'll get a call. Well, it was one of the most fortunate calls I've gotten because I joined this commission. It's very small, probably 5 civilians on it, and we've come from different venues. So I'm the business representative. And we had a few, I didn't know what to expect. We had a few conference calls and a couple of meetings, but we didn't do anything. And then in January of 2003, we got on a military aircraft, and we flew into Kabul, Afghanistan, with guys with night vision goggles looking out the window for mortar fire. It was still considered a war zone post-conflict. And I have to say it was the most incredible thing I've ever done. Well, we met with everyone, all the government ministers, and toured various things. But for me, the compelling moment was our last visit of the trip. We went into a kind of a bombed-out school building, cinder block building, jaggedy, no windows, you know, no heat. And this is winter, so it's 25, 30 degrees. I was wearing my down raincoat and my wool suit, and I was freezing, and found dozens and dozens of women and children living, squatting in this building. And our guide, our government guide, told us that they were really going to rebuild this school, but they were waiting to the spring so that they wouldn't kick the women and children out into the street in the cold. So I came away from that saying, okay, what am I going to do personally to help these women and children? What can one person do? Well, again, I see the world through a business lens, so I thought, okay, I'm going to give them jobs. I'm going to figure out some industries that I can convince to go into Afghanistan and build factories or do something to employ women. Well, I started by hiring a young woman from the UN to do some research, and we looked at Commerce Department data and all kinds of stuff. And what we rapidly concluded, especially after I talked to a number of friends in the private sector who have companies that have factories, that the private sector was simply not willing, private capital was not willing to go into that kind of a post-conflict situation. Wasn't going to happen. So we fell back. We looked at other possibilities. And the long and the short of it is, in a country with virtually no infrastructure and of any sort, there wasn't much these women could do. But what they could do was a traditional skill that has been going on for millennia, which is weaving carpets. And what we concluded was we would help try to create a company that would help restart the rug industry in Afghanistan, which prior to the 25 years of war had been a vibrant export market. So with that in mind, and remember, I knew virtually nothing about Afghanistan, nothing about rugs, and quite honestly, nothing about international development or what I should be doing or how we should be approaching this. We started a company, and the company is called Arzu Rugs. Arzu means hope in Dari, and what we're really about is about hope. Hope that these families that are enrolled in our project, and we now have about 2,000 people in our project over the 2-year period, family groups weave in their homes cottage industry. We negotiate with the private sector wool merchants, rug people, because the woman individually has no negotiating power. She's behind a walled home. She's taking her same amount of labor to weave a rug that no one would buy in the Western world because of shoddy materials, poor color palette choices from a Western perspective. So we provide 2 things. On the business side, we provide the design input and negotiate direct with the private sector there to ensure that she gets the finest materials and the appropriate patterns and graphs, and we pay for all of that because women were having to go into debt to buy the materials to weave the rug, and then they were paying someone to take the rug away and sell it for them for whatever they could get. So many hands touched the rugs that the women who were doing the work ended up with very little. So we became, in effect, the ultimate middleman. We do all that stuff, and we bring the rugs here and sell them. But from a capital, so I looked at this thing like a startup business. But from a business perspective, where do you get the capital to start a business? Well, you start friends and family money. That was me. I funded the thing for the first year until we could get some actual VC money in. But no VC and no private company is going to put any money into Afghanistan. So I entered the process of getting funding from USAID, the Agency for International Development, which in and of itself is a whole story.
Our tax dollars at work.
But your tax dollars are working very well. And so over a three-year period, we're in at year two now, we will have gotten the funding to get us, we project, to cash flow positive. Once we go to cash flow positive, then every marginal sale of a rug drops to our bottom line. Again, I think of this as a business, but when we went to incorporate, I incorporated as a nonprofit. We are a 501c3 here in the United States, which meant we could take donations, but our mission is to become, to create a new template that could be replicable in other parts of the world that's a self-funding model, so that ultimately the proceeds from the sales here, a very high-quality, handmade product, funds the entire program on the back end. And we are very much a public-private partnership in that regard. We also are a blend of business and economic empowerment with social benefits. Because we, as we started to work with these villages, and by definition, we said we're going to do it a certain way. Again, I didn't know any better. That's why we decided to do this, because most NGOs would not have ventured where we dared to tread. We work in remote rural villages with destitute women, giving priority to widows. Widows, they are still chattel. Women are still chattel. No rights of inheritance, no rights to their children. No human rights, basically. And so we work in remote villages with an all-indigenous staff, because part of our mission, too, is to train local people to run businesses so that when everyone else leaves, there'll be a cadre of people that can grow the middle class in this country. And both of those decisions created a whole series of interesting logistical issues, which we can talk about later. But when we went into these villages, we realized it's not just the money. Yes, they're desperately in need of getting out of debt, of putting food on the table, but it's also about health. We have identified, and this was one of the fascinating things at breakfast today, the single biggest health issue in these villages is lack of water or unclean water. And just as Jonathan was saying, it's primarily children in Afghanistan who are walking the miles carrying the heavy buckets. And Afghanistan happens to be the most heavily landmined country in the world. Every week, hundreds and hundreds of children are losing their limbs or dying because they can't get water. And there we're talking literally no water. So we decided early on that we were going to have three beneficiaries to our project: the woman herself, and we accomplished that by employing her, taking the risk out of her wages, and paying her 150% of the market rate into her hands in a little ceremony. What that accomplishes is for someone who is considered overhead in the household, she's now become the dominant wage earner. And her status and dignity in the household rise with nothing else happening.
That's huge. Yeah,
so that's that's the woman herself. Secondly, the second beneficiary is the family group, because they're large families. Widows do not live on their own. They live under the auspices of their dead husbands' families and are often treated as servants. We have a deal, and we go into the village. We first go to the village elders to ask permission to work in the village. Without that, can't do it. Secondly, we go to the patriarch of the family, explain our program, explain the rights and responsibilities for the family, and with his permission, we then employ the women. and register the family into our program. Now, this is the deal. There's a deal. Here we're going to give you a 50% bonus, but there's, in exchange for that, they thumbprint a social contract, and the deal is that all children in the household, girls and boys, go to school. And we register them, and we monitor it. We pull attendance sheets from the schools. We drop in and make surprise visits. This is a very grassroots, non-top-down. This is a bottoms-up project. The second deal is that all women in the household, including the older girls, because they're married after puberty, an average woman has a life expectancy of 40 years and 8 pregnancies, 8 children. Everyone is a life-threatening occurrence. So all of the girls and women must attend literacy classes, which we set up by partnering with local teachers and local NGOs, because we're trying to spur local economies. And we have, and that's the deal, and that's the basis. Now, that's our Afghan program.
And the third level?
The third level is the community as a whole. Because what we don't want to create in these small villages is the haves and the have-nots. So every time our sales run a little ahead of production, we siphon off the cash for a community infrastructure project. And we've built so far one school. We funded desks for 500 children in 2 other schools where the organization that built the schools ran out of money. And we're currently undertaking what I think is our most exciting water-related project, is we're building a bathhouse for women in Bamiyan, where those big Buddhas were blown up. That's the minority Shi'i area, and we're particularly harshly treated by the fundamentalist Sunni. We went to the governor of Bamiyan, who's the only governor, woman governor in the history of Afghanistan, 5,000 years, and said, if you could have one thing, what would you like? What do you think women would want? And she said, a bathhouse, where they can actually clean themselves. And so that involves a lot of logistics. It involves well digging and water, and that's our project, and we expect to break ground in the fall.
And that's underway now. Say a little bit about, and then we want to turn to Susan to offer some reflections on how she looks at this work. Say a little bit about the front end here, like the sales end. Who's buying the rugs? How do we get one?
Well,
I know there's one on display here somewhere.
The back end is all of that, and we've been working on that for 3-plus years, actually on the ground with families for 2-plus. So I like to hear that Jonathan sold his company at the 3-year mark, because next year we're going to go cash flow positive. What we do then is we bring the rugs in and have them inspected by multiple rug experts in the United States to look at the quality. We've reached out to the design community. In order for us to fund our project with this new template, we need to go direct to the consumer and direct to the trade, because we need the margin. We have to retain the margin, because that's what runs the projects and pays for it. So at the end of the day, our goal is to not have to ever fundraise. We're a 501c3. If someone wants to build a school, we'll build it for you, and we're happy to take your money. But we want the operations of the core projects funded from the project itself. That's our goal. So we're right now in the development of what I call the U.S. program, which is the distribution and marketing. And so far, we've rolled out to East Coast cities, Boston, New York, Washington, Chicago. We did Aspen over the weekend with a private reception. We consider them sort of turbocharged Tupperware parties, where people in the community who are interested will host an event, invite their friends, I invite my friends, and people come, because once you touch and feel the rugs, it's a different buying decision. It's not about, is this good quality? Are they beautiful? It's about, gee, which pattern do I want and what size do I need? And do you have it on the loom, or do you need to put one on for me? Or should I take this one? We've been able to, frankly, sell our production because it's been ramping up. And our break-even point is about 1,000 rugs a year. Every piece is unique. That's not that many rugs, in my view. We've been able to sell pretty much everything we've produced to date through friends of Connie's and friends of Connie's. And so, but to institutionalize it really involves building a brand. And that's where I'm going to lean on this guy, because he's done that and is an expert. But let me just finish this one thing, because our brand is, Arzu means hope. It's not just about hope there for better future. What Arzu does here, just like Ethos Water, is it gives the consumer in America a choice that simply by buying a product that they would already buy or desire for their home, they are directly positively impacting the world.
Fabulous. Two great stories.
The price range, we try to price at about 25% below going to a rug dealer comparable cost. So an 8x10 would be about $8,000. And a small rug would be $2,000. But this is hand-carded wool, hand-spun wool, natural dye.
And aren't there some here on the campus that people
want
to go
see? Yes, and actually, in the plenary sessions, the dais where you see the rugs, those are Arzu rugs. So go up in the break and touch and feel them. And then here's our website. So
on the speakers platforms.
Where you see there's three of them here.
Very quick question. Then we're going to.
As a former textile designer, Weaver. I'm still a textile designer, but a Weaver. These women, they knew how to weave.
Oh, good question.
They had looms in their homes.
Good question.
These are skilled weavers because the tribal tradition is that women learn to weave. There's an old Turkoman saying that the bridegroom's family doesn't look at her face, they look at her hands to see if she can weave.
So even though 25 years that industry has really been in deep decline, that tradition of weaving has still been sustained?
Yes and no. There are many patterns that are at risk because the tribes of women and weavers have been dispersed to refugee camps, etc. So we're drawing on a historical and traditional skill and trying to revive it the way it used to be with the traditional materials and dyes.
Thank you. Susan, let me turn to you. Susan approaches this from a very different kind of background, not a businesswoman. She is, in fact, the president of Chicago Theological Seminary, a theologian herself, author of many books. She's been an ordained minister since 1974. Mm-hmm. So you must have been one of the first women ordained by the United Church of Christ?
We've been ordaining women for 150 years.
Oh, never mind then. All right. Well, good for you.
You're not the Episcopalian.
And has an interesting perspective. So please, tell us more about.
Well, you feel inspired? Can I get an amen?
Amen.
Amen.
Okay. I mean, people think that spirituality is some kind of esoteric, otherworldly thing. And one of the things I wanted to bring as Latin backup here is that feeling is spirituality. That's what that is, when your actions and your values actually match. I've been a lifelong peace activist, and I talk to people, and they say, well, of course everyone wants peace. Wouldn't that be nice? But it isn't possible. Well, actually, it's been my experience that peace can be built, but it doesn't just happen. I did pretty well yesterday with giving a homework assignment, so I'm going to try one today as well. There's a book called Just Peacemaking, 10 Strategies to End War. It's edited by Glenn Stassen. I have a chapter in it. It's 22 theologians and ethicists writing 10 practices that tend to increase peace and decrease war. And one of the chapters is about encouraging economic participation in an economy. That when people participate and invest and feel tied to their economy, that this tends, as was said, to increase the middle class, and it is a stabilizing influence, especially in a post-conflict situation, which can then, again, spin out of control and become, again, a conflict situation if you do not invest in the kinds of economic structures, the kinds of interventions, if I can say, that is what you are doing in that kind of strategic way that you give people water. What happens to that woman's productivity when she doesn't have to walk 6 hours a day? Or that child's productivity, that child's health? And then you build also, from the ground up, people's investment in their political participation in their economy. And two chapters are how to build participatory economic systems, how to build participatory political systems. And so it was one thing I wanted to contribute, but the most important thing I wanted to contribute is something that Jonathan said. It's possible. It is literally possible to do these things. This is not a theory of how you do this. This is not a theory. It's not a white paper. It's not a proposal. These are actual practices that have gone on, and these folks are just like you. They're just like me. They're people who have gifts and skills that they are able to invest in this way. It was very interesting to me, and I asked, you know, this is ethos, which means ethics. This is arzu, which means hope. And I think one of the greatest barriers to peace in the world is that people despair that it isn't possible, and they don't practice their ethics. Somebody said once, Christianity is a great idea if someone would try it. So it seems to me that this is an example of how good actually works. It's the fundamental human right to live decently. So that's my backup.
What we're going to do, I know you all have questions, thoughts that you'd like to share, and we're going to open up the conversation, but we're going to do two other things first. I want to turn to Madeline. I've got a couple questions I want to pose back to our examples to learn a little bit more about where these are heading. But I wanted to just get one other example in the room. And Madeline, the connections between peace and economic development. Tell us a little bit about what you're doing in the Middle East.
Well, let me just, to follow up on what Susie said, is... You can go at this from kind of the moral high ground idealistic view, or you can go at it from a purely pragmatic view. Having tried both, I've decided that, you know, I sometimes describe myself as a realistic idealist or an idealistic realist, but you have to do both. Mm-hmm. I happen to believe, as a former U.S. foreign policy maker, that it's actually better for the world, for the U.S., if the world is at peace and is filled with democracies. The only way to get a democracy is by having a middle class, and the only way to get a middle class is by having a functioning economy. So you can look at it from that perspective. One of the things that the Aspen Institute has done is create this Middle East Strategy Group, and the purpose of it has been, and it started really just about a year ago here, is to deal with Gaza. And the issue there was, a year ago, there were Israeli and Palestinian business people who, in fact, wanted to cooperate to set up businesses in Gaza that would employ people, because part of the issue is how you get employment, especially in countries that have a high young population. And so this was something that we felt very hopeful about. And if you notice, I keep talking in the past tense. There were four projects that really involved the Israeli and Palestinian business people with American support. One was to have a cut-and-sew center, I think a lot, again, in terms of women who were able to actually either set up small enterprises or work in their own homes to work with textiles, some just, you know, making uniforms, others things that were more complicated or more artistic in some form. The other was to build apartment buildings, because the way that the Palestinians live is different from the way that the Israelis live, and that was going to employ a lot of people, to build a hospital and also to build a power plant and a call center. Those were the various projects. And it really, I think, was going pretty well. I think that what was interesting is an American aspect to it, which is the Overseas Private Investment Corporation, which is a guarantee system for investment in difficult areas, had in fact, because one of the great things about Aspen is there are a lot of people involved in it, and one of them is Senator Feinstein, who actually has something to do with budgets, and was able to propose legislation or a cut in the an addition in the budget that would, in fact, allow for OPIC to do the funding. Things are, as you can well imagine, a little bit on hold, given what is going on in the Middle East. But it is another example of what possibilities are in terms of business people on the ground using their skills to come together. I would just like to point out the numbers in some of this.
The whole U.S. assistance budget, and Secretary Powell and I were together about 2 weeks ago trying to get some traction on this, is $30 billion. Turns out it's just about the same amount that Warren Buffett gave for
It's less.
May be like $1 billion less. What's a billion? But I. But basically, it's, you know, we're not all Warren Buffetts, but I think it does in fact show the importance of supplementing a lot of the work that is done through the government. And I think that I've been fascinated in listening to your two examples. I certainly know about the water. I saw that everywhere. It doesn't matter where. I've been to the shanty towns outside of Cape Town. I've been to a place we don't even deal with, Burma, where there was a water pump being installed by UNICEF, and I think that's very important. And then I have to say, Connie, I went, one of my most moving trips was to go to the refugee camps in Peshawar, which is where the Afghan women went as the Taliban were taking over. And they really are a very entrepreneurial group of people who have terribly sad stories to tell, but who want to put themselves back together. And I obviously agree with Susan about the spirituality of it. I think we have to understand that it makes us feel good and we're doing good. And for me also, now that I'm in my new life, I really do think there are issues that right and left can work on together. And doing this kind of work is
this
not
is
a partisan issue.
This is
and it really helps in terms, because one, I mean, it's nice. You guys are making money, and that you can't expect corporations to be philanthropic organizations, but they can, in fact, do a lot of work in public-private partnership.
Well, and in fact, if we can get it at the point, a tipping point, where there's really an economic model that's working, the potential to grow something is much more significant.
Yeah.
Connie, I want to turn back to you for a second. You said this morning over breakfast to me that I heard you say to Jonathan that there were several points along the way when you were ready to give up. Can you talk a little bit about that and what got you through, or what some of these, a couple of, maybe just one example of a turning point in this business?
Well, I think, and Jonathan, I'm sure, has had these same moments of doubt as in building his business. But it's just logistically, the sheer logistics of trying to get anything done in Afghanistan are overwhelming. For instance, when we started, there was no central bank, which meant you couldn't wire transfer money into the country. So how do you get money in to pay people? Well, you put it on a donkey and it goes over the mountains in cash. It's a cash economy. So now fast forward, and we're now able to wire money into the country, but there are no ATMs. There's no checks. So it's still a cash economy. And what became apparent to us now that we're working in remote areas, we'd be giving staff who travel without security, these are local people, $5,000. Well, people get killed for a lot less than that, and so we began to figure out what could we do to, you know, we have a problem here. You know what we do? We use the hawala system. That is the money changers in the marketplace from 2,000 years ago, and we have a contract with this guy. We say we need $10,000 in Anhui next Thursday, and some guy shows up with $10,000 in Anhui next Thursday. And we all this for 1.5%. That's less than American Express charges you for your credit card. That's just an example of there are a million of those things. But I think for me, the first year, I worry about, each year I've worried. The first year when I was just in a research mode, I worried that I would never be able to find a reasonable and immediate way to employ women. There are lots of things you can do in 5 years, but what could we do today? Year two, I worried about how are we ever going to get a trained staff that can actually keep a receipt. It's a cash business that can write a report. Funny example, we have a gender-segregated society. So each of our teams have to have men, and we have a male and a female monitor. Well, we were getting these reports back from the field. We're like, aren't these people talking to each other? No, they weren't. They were not related. So the two employees could not meet in a public place and talk about our work. So we solved that by hiring the nephew of the woman. And then now, and he had some computer skills. So now the three of them can meet, and our reports come back great.
Because that makes it safe for the two of them to be together, having the nephew there?
Yes, yes. In this rural village, it's custom, not law. And then the third year, it was, am I ever going to be able to get the quality control on the product? And we did lots of things with that, and now we're fine on that. And now I think I'm going to have 1,000 rugs sitting in my living room. We have to figure out how to institutionalize the distribution. So next year I hope my problem will be have all this profit, which how will we ever spend it all in building schools and bathhouses?
A wonderful problem to have. Jonathan, bumps along the road.
There were lots of bumps along the road. First of all, I had 2 children during the time that I launched Ethos. And so children take a lot of time. And I think the real reason why Ethos succeeded is my wife is exceedingly patient and exceedingly generous and exceedingly kind. But we needed to raise the money to make this business work. You know, it takes, we heard estimates of $8 to $10 million to create a new consumer brand in this kind of packaged goods space. We didn't have anything like that. And it was interesting in that we went and sought investment, and we had people say, wow, what a great idea. When I drink this water, someone gets clean water. That sounds wonderful. Great. So we sought out venture capitalists and institutionals and angel investors, and we did a little bit of work with foundations and looked at SBA loans and. We probably did 175 to 200 meetings trying to get people to donate, to invest in Ethos. No one would. They all said, well, let me get this straight. Sounds great, but you're a first-time entrepreneur, yes. You're going to go up against multinational corporations like Coke and Pepsi and Nestle, yes. Your water is just water, yes. And you want to donate half of the profits that you make. So I had more people than I could count tell me, good luck with your project. So we ended up bootstrapping it for a long time. We ended up, you know, delivering the product out of the back of my Nissan. And then we hired a guitar player in L.A. to work part-time for us. He'd throw the cases in his pickup truck. And we paid him $3 a case to deliver the water. It was pretty challenging. Mm. We were really fortunate that we did take an investment from the Omidyar Network. Pierre Omidyar, who is the chairman and founder of eBay, extraordinary person, very generous as well, and very interested in investing in philanthropic businesses.
A grant or an investment?
It was an investment.
How much?
And he... upwards of $2 million. And Pierre looked at us, though, and said, you know, I'm going to invest this business because I think it makes sense, but I'm not going to cut you any slack. And so we had incredibly challenging terms. It wasn't easy. And he was very demanding.
Are they still in?
Well, since the sale to Starbucks.
They got taken out.
Yeah.
So success all around on that.
Success all around. And tremendous return on his investment.
John, say a little bit about, and I'm going to come back to you, Connie, and then we're going to open the whole thing up. What's ahead? You have now actually exited the business as founder and full time.
Well, back to that wife and kids.
Back to the wife and kids.
So
they're getting their share.
We agreed, my wife and I, that we would spend the summer really investing in the family and sort of reflecting and relaxing a bit, reflecting on what we've accomplished. And now I finally have an opportunity. There were so many learnings along the way. I mean, this business defied gravity in most respects. Everyone told us it wouldn't work. So now I finally have a chance to pursue some of those other business ideas that I developed along the way.
And on, if you think ahead of Ethos, what's the next big step there?
So as a result, you can imagine this. About a year ago, a little over a year ago, we were selling between 250, maybe 300 bottles a day. Today, through Starbucks, we're selling upwards of 70,000 bottles a day.
Incredible.
We just concluded a deal with Pepsi that will grow our distribution between 20 and 50x within the next 18 to 24 months.
So this is now Starbucks' problem and opportunity.
Yeah, that's right. So I think there's clearly some major operational hurdles that need to be crossed because this brand will be enormous, and there'll be a lot of work along the way to create the production capabilities to support it. Pepsi knows a little bit about handling beverages, though, so we're fairly confident. And I think as well, this is going to we were going to raise so much money. I mean, we will be investing scores of millions of dollars into clean water programs in places, you know, Central America, South Asia, Southeast Asia, Sub-Saharan Africa. It'll be extraordinary. We'll have a massive impact on the lives of hundreds of thousands of people, upwards of millions. So I think that's the opportunity.
Connie, opportunities ahead, and then we'll open it up.
Well, I have sort of short-term, medium-term, long-term. And I think short term is to get this company to cash flow positive. Yes, it's a charity and it's a 501c3, but I think of it as a company. Medium term is to get it profitable enough that we can hire a president to run it and take me out of the picture, because I work completely pro bono and it's a 24/7 kind of a job. And of course, I'll stay then from the lofty position of chairman of the board and do the strategic stuff. And then long term, if we can actually get this model of self-sustainability working and get the economics right, there's no reason it cannot be replicated in other products in Afghanistan and in other countries in either the same or different products. Every single country that I know of in the third world has some indigenous craft that women produce. The problems of these women co-op groups are universal. They lack any design reconnaissance coming from the United States. So they weave, knit, whatever, what I call tribal tchotchkes, which are not an export quality product and will not create the kind of cash flow opportunity to make these projects self-sustainable. So design reconnaissance, which is what we've provided from experts around the country to our rug project, is number one. And then the big problem they all share is they have no distribution capability. And because by definition they're capacity constrained, you can only knit, weave, whatever you do, 24/7, which is not the desired lifestyle, you by definition cannot just add another piece of equipment at the end of the line and pump out 10,000 more units. So finding the right institutional distribution vehicle through which you could do a roll-up and funnel product from around the world that is high quality, design oriented, and benefits women and children is, to me, the big opportunity. That's now, if I live that long, we'll see.
Well, we hope you do. Yes, I'm going all the way to the back, please.
Adam Tabara from one thing to thank you for those presentations was that actually show what we need in emerging markets, where we're saying that we must have economic development through profits. It is possible to make money in Africa and also make a difference. The only issue here is you have to be very innovative, as those examples have shown. Innovation around volume, innovation around technology. It cannot be business as usual because you have large numbers of people in those communities, very little buying power. But if you can innovate around volume, innovate around technology, you can actually make money in Africa, in poor countries, but also make a difference. So economic development through profits and sustainability of those community-based economic activities. So I appreciate your efforts.
Role of technology here? Any thoughts, Madeline?
Well, I think that we have to be able to try to get technology into the various places, and that becomes a little, it was interesting, it was one of the discussions that people had here during Brainstorm, where there were a lot of CEOs from IT thinking about what the role of technology is, and it's obviously on the cutting edge, but it's hard to figure out exactly which technologies and how to get past the IP problems and all that.
Right, in the front, please. Tell us your name and where you're from.
Stephen Kaufman, Houston. I wanted to ask you, how do you know that the money is being applied effectively? What kind of institution or structure do you have so that you're getting, you know, honest well diggers?
It's certainly an excellent question.
Clean water, stuff like
that. Good question,
big,
John.
Big challenge, right, because there is so much opportunity for graft and corruption and misuse. We work with different kinds of NGOs, first of all, but very, very reputable ones. So there's a lot of very careful screening that goes on. We tried to work initially only with very specific NGOs that only focused on water, had very low overhead, so our money was being used most efficiently. But groups like WaterAid or Water Partners, consumers in the U.S. didn't know about it. So we ended up expanding the groups we work with. So it's not just water-focused groups, but others like CARE, Save the Children, Mercy Corps, and even some multilateral groups like UNICEF. And when we make these investments, we don't just simply give them the money and say, see you later. We created grant agreements. So we invest in them over time, and we will give them an initial amount of money. And then on the basis of the agreement, they have to give us reporting and metrics and images and content.
Pepsi?
Well, now it's Starbucks. First it was Ethos, and now it's Starbucks.
Starbucks.
Yes.
Administering.
Absolutely. Okay. So the Ethos Water Fund has an administrator. And the way the loop works, it's a very positive cycle. Because we believe, and it's sort of being borne out, the more images that we get, the more stories we collect, the more data we can collect, We integrate that into our marketing, and it creates more trust from the consumer point of view, which creates an additional reason to believe and a reason to buy, which generates more money.
And on the marketing point of view, let me just make a comment on that, because I agree with that completely. You know, the Stalin saying of the death of one is a tragedy, the death of many is a statistic. The appeal in the marketing of these products is the direct person-to-person linkage and bridging and communication. So we know every rug comes with the life story of the woman who made that rug. And that's the connection and the bridge building between cultures as well.
Sure.
Colleen spoke about developing an economic model of rugs. If you're comfortable, can you share with us roughly how an $8,000 rug, how does it break down to, how much goes to the woman, roughly, the community, distribution, materials, just rough.
Well, in the context that we are operating at a loss currently, as all startup businesses do, so the long-term model and what we do now, we're running at a deficit, so it doesn't work at the moment. But I would say if you take an $8,000 rug, I would say the woman herself is getting several thousand dollars from that rug. And
how long does it take her to
That's the thing. It may take, an 8x10 could take her 9 months to weave.
And she does that alone?
No, it's with family members, women, and they'll sit in a row, literally, in front of the looms. Now, so you're thinking about it over a long period of time. And they can't survive to get paid at the end. So we pay all along the way because of the need to put money on the table. We do a life assessment initially, and then we do a formal interview every 6 months for life change. And we hear, what are you using the bonus money for? They get out of debt. They put food on the table. They buy shoes for their children. It's incredible. And then you have the rest of the money is about an equal portion is materials, because we're providing the materials, the looms, and all that. And then you have an equal portion that's probably shipping and getting it here. And then we mark it up. And the margin is what's going to go back to pay for the rugs in advance. So we need, you know, it's a cash flow issue.
Great. A couple of those. Yes, in the turquoise.
An example of partnership that can be done, I went to Africa to teach fundraising to people from 8 nations. One of the examples that I gave in order to create a partnership with corporations was, for example, to go to Ford Motor Company. We know that statistically people buy cars after they've driven them. So you make a deal with Ford Motor Company that every person that comes in to test drive a car using the AIDS, you know, project, Ford pays that AIDS NGO $10. And for every car that is sold, Ford pays the NGO for AIDS $100. So it's a self-perpetuating.
So another example of tapping disposable income here and moving it out.
Right.
Yes, please.
Thank you. Gail Stern from Lake Forest, Illinois. What has been so apparent to me is the extraordinary amount of time and effort, and I'm wondering if there was research involved in really understanding your audience. In other words, with regard to your businesses, you know, from an American perspective in our society, we have been educated, and through our experiences have come up through, you know, different ways to execute. And I'm wondering if you, in fact, did take some time prior going into these different cultures to really understand from their perspective their lives. And I know that Madeline Albright has shared with us, you know, with regard to her new book, The Mighty and the Almighty, how important it is to get counsel.
Jonathan, did you do that directly or contract that out through your work with the NGOs?
Did that, or did you learn as you went?
Both.
Okay.
So there's definitely a lot of consultation with these non-governmental organizations. I mean, who am I to know how to most effectively get water to a community living in a mountainous region in Honduras? Or who am I to know how to most effectively help these children, these street children, living in the shanties and urban slums in Nairobi, Kenya? So we work deeply with the NGOs. And, the NGOs that we chose, they had to be on the ground, staffed by locals with deep cultural fluency and a long proven track record before we would work with them. So we spent a lot of time doing that.
Connie, how about you?
We did research up front from an industry perspective and all of that. We do market research, brand research. But we garner all this professional help pro bono. I have to say, that's become my middle name. And we have had wonderful professionals who have contributed, for instance, their marketing expertise, their advertising expertise, because they get passionate about it. And so we gather lots of information, and then we are, in effect, the NGO on the ground. So we are executing, and we are in the homes every 1 to 2 weeks. We're tracking, we're monitoring.
And hiring locals to do this.
And hiring all locals to do that.
This brings a question up about, Susan made a comment earlier this morning about how important it is, you know, that for people to act on their own kind of impulses here. Both of you have business backgrounds. Both of you have MBAs, if I recall. Mm-hmm. Say just quickly how important or how those networks, you both have great Rolodexes from your life experience. How critical was that in your success to date?
Well, it's very critical for mine, because we've done Arzu on a shoestring. And we have a very small staff, because we've been augmented by professionals that we could never afford, I'll tell you that. And I think it's two things. It's not only the Rolodex and the network of contacts and friends of friends who know people who open doors, but it's also about just the business skills and experience and hard knocks that, because I'm a firm believer that marrying private sector business skills with public sector problems can create new solutions. It's not the same old, same old.
Yeah, it was fundamental for me as well. I mean, I think that the skills that you learn in business school, per se, are very helpful. Mm-hmm. But the real-world business experience mattered a lot, too. I mean, I was managing a multi-million-dollar division of a software company before I did this.
And your Rolodex?
You know what I would actually tell you? I think I learned more about what we're calling public-private partnership and learned about how you can use business as an agent of change when I worked in the administration. I think I was very inspired. I worked for Ron Brown at the Commerce Department for a long time. And President Clinton believed in this idea of commercial diplomacy. And when I was at Commerce, we worked on some programs in Gaza and the West Bank, the hotel in Gaza and some other things in Ramallah. And, you know, President Clinton had this vision that we could use the private sector to drive investment in war-torn places like Northern Ireland or Haiti or the West Bank, et cetera. And in doing so, create economic facts on the ground which would lessen somebody's interest in killing one another. Didn't always work, but to me that was very inspiring.
Yes, please.
Question to Connie.
Yes.
Where did your startup money come from?
True startup money came from me. I funded it, and then when I was able to get AID money, that funded the expansion of the ground operations. One thing that I bypassed by becoming a 501c3, I did not want to spend the probably year that it took Jonathan to raise money by calling on 200 different people. I wanted to start the program.
Connie, could you pull out a number out of your head about the total amount of investment capital to date, including USAID and your own private resources?
I would say probably it's not all expended yet, mm-hmm. but committed or expended, probably about $2.5 million over the three-year period.
Yes, sir. Yes, you've been waiting.
I have a question for Secretary Albright.
Tell us who you are and where you're from.
Sir?
Your name and where you're from.
Oh, sorry. Kurt Strand. I have a question for the Secretary, but I first would like to put it in context. There's an infinite opportunity for American companies to do something worthwhile in countries where we all operate. And it goes back to an attitude at the top. The fellow I worked for was called Conrad Hilton, and he had great spirituality, and it started with that. He had a slogan, it was world peace through international trade and power. And then you go into a place, and I have a great understanding of the rug business. When we opened our first hotel in Turkey, the rug industry there had been out of business for about 40 years. But our designers found some people who could still do it. And so all the rugs in that hotel were made by local people, designed by our people.
Fascinating.
Women were employed for the first time. There wasn't a woman working in a hotel in Turkey at that time who was not a prostitute. And you have this opportunity in that business to have a no-win situation. That is that you employ a lot of local people some unskilled. You bring up the skills. You have a policy that you start out with about 15 expatriates, and then you whittle it down. You have a plan.
So big impacts from large businesses and their ability to create a real multiplier effect on the ground. Madeline, any thoughts on that?
So you have infinite opportunities like that. And my question to the secretary is, every embassy has a list of foreign, it's American companies working in that country. I'm talking more about developing countries. You know, anybody can build a hotel in Paris. It's great fun. But to do it in Addis Ababa or in Khartoum or in places like that that I'm familiar with, it's very tough. And you have far more opportunities to do something worthwhile with the locals. If the embassy has a list of the American companies who are working in those countries, is it possible for the embassy, together with the local government that they have access to evaluate the quality of involvement, positive involvement of these companies and give them some kind of a rating?
Hmm. Madeline, rate the companies.
I think that one of the things that we did was to enlarge the numbers and scope of economic officers in embassies. And whenever I traveled, and I met with a lot of American businesses in terms of some of their diplomatic skills and what they could do to get better labor practices and health programs, etc. I think it probably is possible to do that. It's not something that I think was regularly done, but I do think that more can be done on that score. There's certainly some sense about how well various corporations are working in terms of human rights policies, whether they can be done on the basis of whether they're effective.
It would have a real positive effect, because if one company gets such a rating,
that's very interesting.
Would aspire to get too.
Interesting idea.
Sorry, you're waiting in the back. Yes, in the back. I'm sorry, way back. Yes.
Sanjay Mukherjee from Management Center.
Sanjay, hi. Nice to see you.
This is a few reflections on Reverend's comments on spirituality being esoteric. And this is the work that we are trying to do at our Management Center for Human Values, spirituality and management and authentic synthesis for effectiveness. One of the ancient literatures of classical India mentions this very clearly, that if we follow material knowledge to the exclusion of spirit, we are going to end in deeper darkness. And next line is, if we follow spiritual knowledge to the exclusion of matter, then we are going to land up in deepest darkness. But this authentic synthesis of both, you know, it forms the bedrock of this movement towards integrating business and society. One of the living examples here is still there, this organization, last 150 years, Indian spiritual organization with a social purpose. Its motto is for the salvation of the self and for the welfare of the masses, together in the motto, not either or. This is what I wanted to share with you. And the last point on peace, you mentioned about peace about in the macro world, but probably for the business leader who is operating today, and in the context where, you know, Jonathan mentions about the South African condition, there are many examples in Indian condition also. For that, probably, instead of peace, some amount of discontent within the mind space of the leader is important to keep the flame burning, that I have not been able to serve properly with my limited resources. I'll try my better tomorrow.
Susan, comments on this. Spirit and commerce, a much more natural idea of those things coming together in other places in the world than in the U.S. of A.
Things that I find alarming in our current climate is a very pronounced, in the U.S., drift, push towards seeing spirituality as otherworldly, as unconnected to this environment. Why do you need an environment if you're going to be raptured in the next 20 minutes? So I think that the description that you were giving of the self and its ability to positively be an agent of change in the world. That is also work. That is work. Work is a charism. It's a way of being a positive influence in your world. And it generalizes also to a this-worldly spirituality that does not have contempt for this world, for its people, and for the possibilities in this world. And it is, if there's not perfection, this is a problem with otherworldly spirituality, that if it's not perfection, it's nothing. But if one person has a job, if one village gets a well, that's a good. And the world was better than it was before Jonathan and Connie engaged it.
On this side, over here. Yes, C. I'm sorry. Yes, on the far right.
I'm Clive Crook. I'm with the Atlantic Monthly. I had a question for Connie on the Afghan carpet case. I was very interested to hear just how intense an involvement your enterprise had to engage in order to, get the good results that you wanted. Thinking about the way the village societies worked, where you wanted to put the extra money, who, in effect, you needed to buy off within the village to let your program go forward. In some ways, this is a social transformation you're working in these villages as well as an economic one. I was just curious to know whether you'd encountered any resistance to that degree of intensity.
First of all, I want to say one thing. We don't buy anyone off with cash. No, we do not. And that's been one of our operating principles. If a village is going to require that, we go to a different village. And in terms of resistance, on an individual family level, there may be a patriarch who says, no, I'm not going to agree to this, and we move to the house next door. We have not had any trouble getting families to agree, but I will tell you, the proof is in the pudding. The first bonus we paid in the first village spread like wire file. We were oversubscribed the next day. We have wait lists for families. But it is a transformational thing for the village. That's what we're trying to do, because what we're really after is to try to create some climate of equality for women within cultural norms that everyone can accept. And I have to say two little vignettes of examples of what we're trying to do. One is that in our first village, we've always said if the men want literacy classes, it's recommended and optional, but not required. Women, it's required. We had our first delegation of men come from a village saying, hey, what about us? And we've just started our first literacy class in a village for men. The second is that we had our first young woman, and I say woman because she's 25 years old, graduate from 12th grade, education interrupted. Well, what we did is we went to her father and convinced him to let her leave the village for additional education. We tried to get her all the way into engineering school, and he wouldn't buy it. So she's in midwife school, and we underwrote the scholarship to allow her to do that and convinced her family that it would be a good thing. She will come back to the village to serve a very important need. But the visual of this is we had a ceremony for her where she was on the dais, and we invited the village elders and all the big male muckety-mucks in the district who work for UN and World Bank, and we had a little luncheon. So the visual, we videotaped this, is there she is making her speech, accepting the scholarship, to a group of men who are very important in the village, who are there to honor her.
Cover story potential?
Maybe, absolutely. There's no muttering, no muttering in the background, no sort of ripple of discontent.
I think it relates to, perhaps it relates to Afghanistan specifically. Madeline would know more about that. But after, these people know what 25 years of war means. And we have found virtually in the areas, now we do not work in the south where the Taliban still operates. We work in the center and in the north. But we've not seen fathers saying, I don't want my daughter to be educated.
No. We're going to take three more, so speak really fast so we can get done on time. Sir.
I'm Herb Feinzig. I'm from Carbondale, Colorado, where I attend the very question for Jonathan. I was listening to you talk about NGOs And I'm wondering if you've done any work with Rotary International, which is an organization that is throughout the world and does a lot of work in developing water and wells and baths and other things in different countries. And I'm involved in the board of the Rotary. I'd like to get together with you.
Sure. Should I respond to
that? Yeah, sure. Or you can, if you've got a connection, good idea.
Yeah, we have worked with Rotary. For those of you who don't know, Rotary International is a phenomenal service organization around the world, did amazing things on polio, have taken up water as their new cause. We actually have done some collaboration with them. I'd be happy to talk to you about it afterwards.
Talk more about it afterwards. Yes, ma'am, please.
I guess to Connie and Governor, please. You have now got a format for what to do to box that and to move it. Do you have a training program in place that you can take what you've learned?
Training for?
For the intermediaries in between of how you're going to be able to, you know, the guy who you got to deliver the money. Is there a way in which another village where you need another guy but he doesn't know how to do it yet, and you train that man trains this guy to do that all along the line from the bottom up, from training the girls of how to weave, which I assume it goes on, but...
Staying in Afghanistan, or are you
I'm just talking about global. I mean, you know, the International Year of the Woman in 1974 and in Nairobi and all of those kind of cottage industries that started there, and they were start-stop, and as you said, unless they got financed, they really weren't able to continue and produce. And so I just wonder if there is a format or a paper or a way in which, in every country it's different, but there's some fundamental things that you need to do, and if there's a way to box that.
And the answer is we have not done that yet because we're still in our learning mode. But I would fully... I would fully anticipate, though, that we try to codify the basic approaches that, because we've done a lot of things that haven't worked, but being small, we just disregard those and do something else until it works. So I do hope that at some point we'll be able to share this methodology once we prove it all the way out. And again, we're midstream. We're not successful yet to help others jumpstart the effort for their project.
Last question in the back, and then I'll have a final question to the panelists. Yes.
Jonathan Oppenheimer, I'm from South Africa. Everything you've described is wonderful and right. Is there a way to leverage this into business? And I'd like to think that we're doing some of that. Case in point, Botswana, the full discovery of diamonds at 3 kilometers of tarmac road, not 3,000 kilometers from all the major arteries. There is universal education to high school level. They're talking about looking if they built a university. And that was only because of the investment and the partnership, and we are, in many instances...
And we is who?
Sorry?
Who is we in this case?
We is De Beers.
De Beers.
And De Beers doing schools in the areas we operate, and we're helping government build those schools.
So in some ways, Starbucks is an example of this, because having moved this business into Starbucks with its global capacity, that would be an example.
To give you the sense of what we're doing in Africa, we're supporting plus minus directly employed 20-odd thousand people. And indirectly, through our efforts, we're supporting communities which are most probably hundreds of thousands of people could easily reach. I mean, if you ask Botswana's diamond dependent population, 2.5 million people. Well,
terrific example. Marvelous. Terrific example. Another end of the spectrum, another wonderful example.
Yeah,
thanks
thanks
for sharing that. Let me close with asking the two of you, Connie and Jonathan, what could you... If you could wave a magic wand and have everybody in this room go out and do something that's going to help you guys succeed and build and grow your two businesses.
Other than buy a lot of Arzu rugs and Ethos Walmart.
Yeah, give a little flavor for what kinds of things people, what do we do here?
Well, for us, you can buy a rug. And I have a little handout here with our website where you can see them. But I think it's word of mouth. For us, word of mouth marketing is what we're doing because we're never going to have tens of thousands of units coming out of this project. We're going to have a very discreet capacity, which we ought to be able to get this thing to profitability sooner rather than later. So I just urge you to look around your house or houses, and I am quite confident there's a floor somewhere that will look better with an Arzu rug on it, and also at your friend's house.
You know, Jonathan? It's funny. One of the most frequently asked questions that we got from consumers was exactly this. They said, wow, I bought your water. I understand it. So what else can I do? how can I get involved? And we were working on developing programs so that we could get our consumers involved to go to a community in Africa, to get involved with a local water-related NGO, Rotary or otherwise. But for all of you, other than buying Ethos Water, it's word of mouth. It's telling your friends. It's sharing the story. Because for me, again, the purchases are great, but what's more important is that people understand. And then all of you will find your own way, find your own inspiration to get involved.
All right, so we all go out and multiply. Thank you. Susan, Madeline, Jonathan.